Hey everyone, welcome back. Thanks for sticking with me over the last 3 years. Today's episode needs a little explanation, but first, a word about our sponsor. If you've been listening to Ranching Reboot this year, you'll know our sponsor is Land Trust, the Recreation Access Network. Land Trust exists to enable the enjoyment, profitability, and sustainability of America's undeveloped private lands. Land Trust is all about connecting landowners with outdoor adventurers. We built an online marketplace that makes it easy for both of you to find each other. Here's the deal. Landowners, you've got this amazing land, right? You could share it and make some extra income. Hunters, hikers, campers, you folks crave new places to explore. Land Trust connects you with those special spots all on private land. We believe in working lands. That means keeping farms and ranches productive while also offering conservation and recreation. It's a win-win for everyone. Rural areas stay beautiful, landowners make money, and outdoor enthusiasts get their fix of nature. But wait, there's more. Land Trust isn't just about transactions. We're building a community. Landowners share their land and experiences while outdoor enthusiasts explore with respect. It's a chance to connect and learn from each other. Neighbors who partner with us see benefits for their whole town. More visitors means more money circulating, which is good for everyone. Here at Land Trust is our middle name. We use a simple platform with clear rules. No hidden fees, no fine print. Landowners get a good deal with protection, and outdoor enthusiasts get amazing experiences without any surprises. Are you ready to explore? Join Land Trust, the Recreation Access Network. See for yourself how Land Trust can create amazing experiences for both landowners and outdoor adventurers. Check out www.landtrust.com/reboot or just click the link in the show notes. Okay, back to this week's episode. I had some technical issues with the episode I wanted to use this week, so my good friend Bob Kinford stepped up for a Plan B recording, and in my typical fashion, it's last minute and sort of experimental. We got cut a little short on our episode, so we'll take that as an opportunity to do something different. Bob and I have a follow-up scheduled literally tomorrow from release day, and here's what we're going to do. So I'm using a different recording approach. Instead of using Zoom, I'm using an app called Squadcast. It's a little bit more geared for podcasters. Makes my life in post-production a little easier. And the best part is, fans can join using a special link into what's called Backstage. You can watch and listen live. You can ask questions in the chat. And this is really cool. I can even bring someone from Backstage to the main stage and bring them into the podcast and let them participate. So we're going to try that out. Okay, the details of how you can join in. The link to join the Backstage is going to be on my Discord server, so you got to be part of the Discord crew to join in. So come over to the Discord, find the link for the Squadcast recording in the events section, and come hang out. And final note, this episode does end kind of abruptly. Bob had some computer issues. His wife got home when he came home when he was sorting those out, and he couldn't continue. So we're going to release the conversation we already had and hope some of y'all will join us for the follow-up. All right, that's it. Let's go.
Counting down and everything.
Yeah, that's new. So, hi, Bob. Here with Bob Kinford, and we're trying Squadcast instead of Zoom. Hopefully this works, and maybe some of the guys from our Discord server are going to join us and ask questions and harass and heckle, I suppose. How are you today, Bob?
You know, I never check. It's going to change. I've been going through the winter habit. I've only had one little job through the winter, feeding cows 3 times a week. And I mean, there's nothing for them to eat on that place. I mean, it's 18,000 acres and it won't feed 60 cows.
Wow.
Talk about dry, we are dry.
I know where you're at. Why don't you tell everybody else where you're at that doesn't know.
In far west Texas, out where they claim it's God's country, but I think Satan has the lease on it. And these people have, you know, I mean, they're good people, but they're conventional operators and stuck into that whole damn paradigm. They've got another smaller place they just picked up. It hasn't been grazed for 3 years. And we went down, we fixed fences and water lines on the one place, and then we gathered the other day, and he got a offer on his cows, and he just sold that set of cows. So my job of going down and starting an IMG program on the other place just kind of beep
out. Is gone.
But the thing is that place hasn't been grazed in 3 years. If they don't graze it, and if they don't get it grazed this year, they are going to lose half the grass.
Okay.
And there's no way of trying to convince them of this because they're stuck in the paradigm. Oh, you got to let it rest.
Okay. Can you keep going? Tell me why that's wrong. Tell me why you think it's wrong.
It's not because I think it's wrong. It's just been what nature's shown me down here. Once you get past about 2 years rest, it starts oxidizing. And this is already, it's got a year's worth of oxidization on there. They've got a little bit of grass from last year where they did get a little bit of rain over there that's still fairly healthy, but it's showing signs of oxidization. And if it goes one more year, the grass just isn't going to grow. All that grass is just going to be dead. And since the sunlight can't get to the ground, even if it does get enough rain to get wet, there's not going to be enough. The grass isn't going to have enough energy to push up through there from seedlings.
Yeah, right. I mean, okay, so that's a problem I would probably solve with fire, but I don't think that people in your part of the world like that.
Well, all the neighboring places see this. I mean, most of them, a fire is going to have to pack its own fuel to spread. You know, and this has got enough oxidized grass on it that it would burn pretty hot. But the thing is burning, that's one of those paradigms that is really, it looks simple, but it's a Rubik's Cube. You know, I kind of tell people that they're making a Rubik's Cube out of the obvious, but on the case of this burning, if you get it too hot, you're going to just bake the ground and it's going to harden it up even more than it is. And a lot of this ground down here, I have actually seen water start to run on a little shower of 0.08 of an inch.
Okay.
So what's going to happen when you bake that ground even harder?
I mean, what you're saying is perfectly valid. And go ahead. I want to let you finish.
But if,
because I have got nothing to argue with you about, and I know that's true in some cases.
If you take that same ground and you get enough herd impact on there to trample it, and then you're also getting your footprints that's going to collect the moisture in that more, and you're also adding nitrogen and phosphorus, everything else that's coming out of that urine and dung to get those microbes going in the soil to where when it rains, something can actually take place.
Right.
They do have some grasses down here that they'll burn. Some people will burn the Tabosa or the giant saccatone. And that giant saccatone, it'll grow up like 8 foot tall, great big bunches. But when you burn it, when it does green up, everything in between it is just charred. It's just dead earth. If you take and dump a bunch of cattle in there and graze it out in the middle of the winter, when people say they won't graze it, but once you put the cattle in there, most cattle will go ahead and eat that. The following spring, when it greens up, you're not just getting that giant saccatone to green up. You're getting all sorts of forbs and different grasses in between all of the bunches. And it makes great quail habitat, turkey habitat, but we're destroying that habitat because we're caught in that paradigm. Well, we burn it and then it comes back better.
What I think I heard you say, I mean, kind of aside from the whole burning thing, is it seems like a lot of that ground down there benefits more from being grazed in the winter than it does during the growing season.
I think every place does. what I've noticed, and I've noticed even getting up, you know, going to visit Hoy's and going over there on the Masto and clear up into Montana, is, and it's kind of counterintuitive, but we always think of those stocks as dead. But
right,
and every species of grass seems to have a little bit different level of what it needs to be grazed down to do this. But if you start looking at those grasses in the spring, something that's being grazed in the winter and not taken all the way down to the ground, but taken down to, say, depending on the species of grass, 3 inches to a foot tall, those stalks will green up before the leaves green up.
Okay.
To where it's kind of kick-starting your photosynthesis on the plant, and then the leaves will kick in next, and those plants will start in faster, greening up faster than the ones that haven't been grazed, or the ones that have been grazed all the way down to the ground. I mean, we're really bad at observing.
And why do you think that is? Because we have such a short attention span, a short time scale?
Oh, here we go over the rabbit hole. people talk about the human race being so inquisitive and so intelligent, and you know, look at all the, I mean, look at this right here. This took some brain power to come up with this shit, right? But in reality, what is it? It's maybe 1% of the population of the world comes up with something like this. Then you got another percent that's, you know, Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk that takes advantage of these people. And then you've got people that are going, oh, wow, we can use this to make money. And they put it into some format where they're making money. Then they got us that are sitting here, we're just doing this for free just because we think we're smart. And then you have the people that are just working paycheck to paycheck. Everybody gets their own little narrow deal, and we're really not that inquisitive. We're really not fucking bright. I know I'm not bright. I just look at things, and I do get curious, but it's like, it's not necessarily because I'm intelligent. It's just because I just want to know things. But I just want to know a narrow range of things. What makes this grass grow? How can I make my cows go better? How can I make my horse friendlier and do more for me? It's all, every bit of it basically burns down to being self-serving and ego. You know, you look at how many people, you look at the tribes that are still around, that people are still living off the land.
Yeah.
So if we were, as a species, so inquisitive, so stinking intelligent, we wouldn't have the diversity of having, you know, Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk over here, and then having some guy down here that's going out and scrounging around in the rainforest for bugs to cook up on a banana leaf.
It's a very strange world we live in. Like, there's some really dramatic contrast if you zoom all the way out.
You know, but we need equality.
We've got it pretty good in this country. And yeah, Elon, love what the guy's doing with SpaceX trying to go to Mars. Like, that's one of the things that I can really nerd out on is what he's building down there, well, on the other side of Texas from you, and what he's trying to do.
But why?
Why? Why does he want to go to Mars?
No. Why do we get interested in that when we don't even know how the hell this planet works? But we're going to go to Mars. We got it screwed up here, so we're going to go start over on Mars, where it's even worse conditions than what we have here. We get in our little box, and then we change our box from this box to this box.
I get your point. Like, why go to Mars? We've got a perfectly good planet here. We've screwed this one up. Can we fix it? I hope so. I hope so for our children's children's children.
Well, yeah.
But here's the important part. I think that I believe Elon when he says human life must become interplanetary if we want to survive, because asteroids wiped out the dinosaurs. That could happen to us. We could kill ourselves with nuclear war, which could happen tomorrow. You know, I think historians are going to look back and say that World War III started somewhere like in between 2019 and 2021. There's all kinds of things. And I think that just having a stable population on another planet, I think that's a worthwhile pursuit. I think it's worthwhile. I really do. But I really question how he's going to get it pulled off. I mean, the amount of mass that has to be transported from Earth to Mars to support a colony, like the amount of mass, just the stuff that they've got to take with them, boggles the mind. Like, we're talking thousands of rocket launches that they've launched three times, right? Thousands of launches just to send the crap before we start sending people.
We're going to kill the climate just on rocket launches going to Mars.
Probably. But then I think, okay, how do you feed a colony on Mars that's literally at best a 9-month rocket ride from Earth?
Okay.
Like, you don't just call Domino's and have a couple of larges delivered. Like, that shit doesn't work.
You know, this, you had a part, and I'm really bad about listening to podcasts. I'm getting to where I almost don't listen to anything because I'm getting overload, and you know me, I'm kind of ADHD, and then I get, you know, an compulsive deal to dive into shit, and it's just kind of, for my own sanity, I'm not listening to a whole lot. But I saw on Discord where you had that gal talking about greenhouses.
Okay.
Now, you were making you made the comment there that, you know, well, it takes too much energy to this and to that. And I got to thinking about that. Nah, it doesn't. Not really. You know, they do the hydroponics where they put in all the chemicals and crap. But at the same time, you could do hydroponics running it off of gray water.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I mean, when I was a kid, you know, you could still have your gray water going out of a drain and we just had a 3-inch hose and the toilet went into the septic tank and everything else went down the hill. And we just want to move that pipe. Well, we want to go fishing. That's where we went to dig worms, because any place else on the property, once you dug down about 6 inches, you were on sandstone. You could dig a 4-foot hole where that gray water had been going, and it was just full of worms.
Okay.
So why do we, you know, we make all of this, all of our water has to go to a sewage plant. And then we got to buy water, put it out on our yard, because it's illegal to just have your gray water from your washing machine going out to water the garden.
Okay, I have some thoughts.
Uh-oh.
And water should be reused, and we throw away a lot of fertility into wastewater systems. Try to keep that concept kind of clean. Everybody knows what we're talking about. There's a lot of fertility value that ends up in that system that should be reclaimed. Okay. And that seems like a pretty obvious one. And I have a gray water drain here at the house. Everything but the toilet goes through there and the shower. The dishwasher, the clothes washer, the kitchen sink, that's what goes out to gray water. The showers, toilets, they all go to the septic. And of course, there's other ways to do it. And where our graywater drain goes, we put our garden, like on our garden is kind of down the graywater drain, and she's got some plans to put some stuff down through there. And it's like the water recycling. Yeah, it works. But then when you start doing it at scale, when you start doing it at scale in a built up area, then you've got people that are taking antibiotics or taking other weird things that end up, you know, that end up getting passed through the body. And, you know, I can see that, you know, when people start moving into towns, all right, we have to deal with this waste problem. It has to stay clean because we can't have people getting sick. And that's the reason why things kind of developed the way they did. The problem is not necessarily like rooted in how we're dealing with these substances. It's because we want to live in cities, and that's just the system that that's what we came up with. You know, we talk about, like, you know, compost. Compost is great. We throw a hell of a lot of it away. And, you know, like you mentioned, I think it was the same podcast that we were talking about the hydroponics, that, you know, 40% of food gets thrown away and most of it's wrapped in single-use plastic. It ends up in a landfill. Why are we composting that?
You know, I'd like to know that, because the local grocery store, you know, we've only got one. They throw away a ton of stuff. They have to pay to have it taken away. And I was going to, what the heck? Why not just take this? I was feeding these cows out here. Why not take that out and just drop it in where you've got little arroyos started and let the cows go in and eat it and trample the heck out of it? And it would have added to the soil fertility, fed the cows. They wouldn't have, what? Nope. It's against company policy. And it's a small chain. It's Lowe's Groceries. And their company policy is, no, we can't do that. And why they have a company policy? I mean, there's towns around that will not allow you to do that. They're bound by regulations that prevent them from doing that. And of course, who makes the regulations? People that don't have a stinking clue.
People that don't have a dog in a fight.
They make a conspiracy to save us by doing something that's just totally 180 degrees opposite of what needs to be done.
Well, that's what politics is.
Yeah.
So back to hydroponics. And I think that was the Allie Cox episode. And my whole point with the energy thing is, okay, instead of growing plants outside in soil, we want to bring them into a building and we're going to grow them in a liquid solution, a liquid nutrient solution that's circulated through. You know, we got to have something to hold the plant so it can grow and the roots can go down into this solution. Yeah. Well, easy way, like the best material to build those things out of is going to be plastic. Plastics take oil. We got to have a pump to circulate the water or the fluid. Okay. That takes energy to drive the pump. Now, all the nutrients that we're putting into the fluid, into this hydroponic solution, where the nutrients come from?
Well, see, there's where your gray water comes in. Do you realize how many?
You're right. You're right with the gray water. But if we're talking about
how many vacant buildings there are in every city, you talk about urban sprawl. As we get urban sprawl, we're also getting inner city decay.
There's, I think I saw
that. I mean, you've got these factories that could be, sounds communist here almost maybe, but
it's okay. Let it
rip.
They
could redesign some of these vacant factories into apartment buildings with with built-in hydroponics, passive solar to help heat, and run it all off the gray water.
That's a very interesting concept. And I'm sure it has some potential. While you were talking, I just had this vision of like something like the Sears Tower, whatever they changed the name of that one to. Just imagine big old building. You know, you've got some shops down on the bottom, and then maybe you've got like a couple levels that raise livestock, and then you've got a couple residential levels and a couple farm levels.
I wouldn't necessarily have livestock in there.
Why not?
Well, you and I probably wouldn't mind having the livestock, but most people wouldn't be able to handle that. They would think it smells bad.
I'm going to go up to the 83rd floor and check on my cows today. I mean, who wouldn't want to go work, you know? Okay, never mind. That's something they're doing in China with the big skyscrapers, I guess.
We found a mole hole in the bottom of the rabbit hole.
Yeah, something like that. But no.
And there's nobody here to heckle us on that. That's bad.
But no, where do the nutrients come from in a hydroponic system? Like, they have to come from somewhere. Do we get them from another plant? Or
work
a chemical process? But so that kind of goes back to like the whole microbiome argument. And, you know, we talk about how plants, when you plant a garden, if you just plant rows of beans, you're going to have one kind of crop. If you intersperse those beans with companion crops and the soil biology really gets going, you're going to have a lower input system that's more productive. So what I'm saying is growing hydroponics in a monoculture with all the synthetic inputs, it's hard for me to see how that's going
to
be
better
or grow healthier food
than food
grown in soil.
Okay, here we go. This is a paradigm. Who the hell comes up with the deal that just because you're growing it hydroponically, it has to be a monoculture? Who says
good question.
That?
Good question. Have you ever seen a hydroponic farm with different species?
No, it's these guys, they go, well, they're just like a conventional farmer. It's, you know, they're going to think out of the box, and they jump out of the conventional farmer box into the hydroponic box, and they're still growing one thing. I actually worked for a guy that had, he was growing tomatoes in hydroponically in Nevada.
Makes sense.
He heated the place. He had a hot water well. And he actually distilled the water for the plants and used that hot water to heat it. But what he did is and it was made out of 2x4s plastic and rain gutter. And he was distilling 200 gallons of water a day in the winter.
Just right out of the atmosphere, just pull it right out of the air.
No, he had it set up, and he was running that hot water into it. Well, that hot water just happened to have a lot of aluminum in it.
Okay.
So when it started getting filled up, he'd pull that out, and he'd stockpile it, and every once in a while, he'd send off a load of aluminum ore.
Interesting.
But all of his nutrients were straight chemicals.
Okay.
Today they've got these places that are doing making their own, like a sourdough starter of microbiology, microbes for the soil. And, you know, there's no reason why a person couldn't be doing that.
I, just sitting here thinking about.
I mean,
just sitting here thinking about that.
There's a lot of different angles, and what I've noticed is we get there's those of us that cannot pass a rabbit hole. We can't do it, and people think we're stinking crazy, and we probably are, but we can't. We don't get locked into one box. We just, you know, people change paradigms and thinking, well, we're thinking out of the box, and all they're doing is just going into a different box.
And not being constrained by a box, I think is.
Yeah. Yeah. But that's what people do, though, is they go from, okay, we're going to go from conventional grazing. We're going to go to regenerative grazing. Well, you've got the guy that does the total grazing. You've got Jim Garish. You've got all these different people out there that are saying you have to do, and you get stuck in that box and you can't get beyond it.
Yeah, okay. So that leads into a good conversation about, and the way I think about it is it's like grazing systems branding. Like, I love Jim Garish, don't get me wrong. But like his grazing brand is MIG. And then there's another gentleman we all know we're talking about when we say total grazing. That's kind of like his brand name. And where I get to, it's like they want to sell a brand name. They want to, like, that's their thing. They want to be recognized for it. And I get it. It's marketing. But where I think people are going wrong is they're buying into it as a system, as a prescriptive system, instead of a paradigm shift, which you and I both know, like you can have your ranch set up one way and you say, okay, I'm going to do this regenerative grazing thing. And you can design a grazing system. Well, will that system work on someone else's? Maybe not. Is that grazing system you design, is that actually appropriate for your context, or are you just using someone else's practices because they sounded cool?
Well, I personally don't like the recreational fence.
That's okay. You don't have to.
You
can't walk enough to do it anyway.
You know, you've got a point there. I spent 12 hours walking around the other day and it about killed me. Luckily, I got on my horse the next day and I was able to get limbered up. But no, seriously, it all goes down to your timing of your graze. And it also makes a difference on how much of the plant that the cattle eat. And something that a lot of people miss out on. I just stumbled on it total by accident, just because the guy I was working under, we had all these pivots, and all the pivots are in Bermuda, and we had the same number for the same class of cattle. Okay, we go in there, and my cattle, after 4 or 5 days, all those calves were grazing right together, grazing just as tight as could be. They would stay in there 3 to 5 days longer than his calves were. And he was doing the Jim Garish deal, daily moves, and his were eating it down within an inch of the ground. And when mine came out, I still had over half the grass left. And then it also recovered faster because of the fact that it was still all green. There was photosynthesis, never stopped. It never got knocked back because they were just taking that top third. So at the end, when we go to ship, which set of cattle would you think would have gained more weight? Those that were eating everything, or just the top third?
I was going to say, I already know, because we had this conversation yesterday,
yeah,
sir.
Yeah, but there might be people that don't know. I mean, there's definitely nobody right. listening today, so it'll be new for them tomorrow.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was the same. It was identical. And like I told you yesterday when I talked to Temple Grandin about it, she said that taking that top third to one half, they're getting the peak nutrition, which allows their rumen to work more efficient. You know, and we make all of this talk about, oh, we've got to be able to make them perform on low performance feed. Well, if they can just take that top third, let all your plants recover faster for the same weight gain, and then one of the results in there that Ricky Scrimmer's cattle do that, and she sent me some video here a couple of years ago where she said it was 107 or 108 degrees at 8 o'clock at night.
Ooh.
And she's built her herd up enough to where their water system can't handle all the cattle on one drink. So they're in this pasture and they're about a half mile away from each other. And the one is up on a hill and the other one's down lower on the side of a hill, right next to a draw that's full of cottonwood trees. The cattle at triple digit weather are laying down ruminating in the sun. When the top group started to graze out, the other group picked up and went with them. So we're wanting to have cattle that are resistant to heat, that do good on low quality forage, you know, because we have to eat more of the plant to harvest more for efficiency, and we're looking at it the wrong way. We need to look at the best way to feed those microbes in that cow's gut to do the best for the cow without overheating the cow.
Yes.
So when we start going for this, you know, we've got to eat more of that plant and utilize that low quality forage. Well, we're making the cow miserable from the heat. They're not as heat tolerant. And then it's taken longer for the grasses to recover.
Yes.
And that's something that when you look at it, it seems like it should be obvious, but we make a Rubik's Cube out of it.
Are we breeding for the wrong things? Let me clarify that. Are we breeding our cattle for the wrong things?
Well, it all depends on what we think is the right thing.
We all want to save the world. We just disagree as to how.
No, I don't even want to save the world. I know there's a bunch of idiots out there that aren't ever going to figure it out, but it'd be nice to be able to give those that are self-sufficient enough that when everything collapses, they can keep making things a little bit better.
I was just thinking that's, we all want to save the world. We just disagree as to how. That's where a lot of the conflict arises, is a lot of people want to save the world. I think Elon wants to save the world.
Oh.
I think Alan Savory wants to save the world. They just disagree as to how.
We don't want to save the world. The world's going to be here with us, whether we're here or not. There's no saving the world. It's saving humanity and everybody that's all, I think it's a big ego trip to be caught up in there in the world trying to save humanity or save the world. And we get so caught up in that ego trip that what I've noticed.
What if we just reframe that and say, instead of saving the world, not even talk about saving soil, we just want to save fertility. Like bovine fertility, soil fertility, human fertility, we want to save fertility.
Well, I want to be able to have fun without getting pregnant.
I mean, I get that, but...
Well, it's, yeah, you're looking at fertility drives everything, basically.
Fertility drives the bus.
Yeah, and there are certain things that, actually, there are certain things that would go along with fertility, which we're not looking at. And that this is part of the reason, too, why we've got so many people like me running around here like this that packing a little bit extra, is hard fertility is being an easy keeper.
Yeah.
And we have so much access to food or food substitutes is so plentiful that it's easy to get fat without having to eat a lot. I mean, it does a lot of things on health-wise, but
it's also pretty easy to eat too much to the point where you're too obese to be fertile.
Yeah, this is true. But if you look at cows, the ones that are really fertile that breed up the most, you know, get the best conception rates, or what? They're the ones that can get by on the least amount of feed.
Yeah.
You look at your Corianis. They're fertile.
They get by on not a whole lot.
Yeah. You know, you can stick them out down here in the desert and they'll stay in good condition, you know, fairly good condition in conditions that would kill other cows. And then you put them into a condition, into an area like where you're at, where they've got a lot of grass, and they stay pretty fat.
Yeah. Well, I mean, when we have rain to grow some grass, they stay fat.
Yeah.
But I think, so, you know, talking about easy keepers, I mean, how are we looking at that? Like, when somebody says, oh, she's an easy keeper, is she an easy keeper because you haul her a bale of alfalfa every month? Is she an easy keeper because she gets 4 pounds of cake every day? Or is she an easy keeper because she lived in the pasture last year for 363 days and you never saw her at the feed wagon?
That all depends on the reality of your own personal box.
Okay. You want to explain that?
Well, okay. It kind of goes with everything. And in my own personal box, I get trapped in the most of the stock market. And you look at these people and they're talking that, you know, oh, well, you don't need stockmanship. My cows go with a bucket of cake. I've got some friends here that the old gal, she got older and she's older than me. She doesn't get around good. And her husband, when he was alive, they started just caking everything, going out all of their cows. And I mean, they've got them out here on big desert pastures of thousands of acres. And they drive around with their trailer and they got a bag of cake and they put a little, they want a couple calves and they go out there and they put some cake in the truck and then they go. It works good. It worked great. And people are thinking, oh, this works really good. But you're not doing that animal any favors.
You're a drug dealer.
Yeah.
And at that point, you're a drug dealer.
This gal's son is starting to get concerned because, you know, he was in the Marines. He got out of the Marines, and he's helping his mom. And, oh, yeah, this worked good. This worked good because that's, you know, when he was a kid, they did things horseback and that, and then went in the Marines, and they completely changed over, and he's thinking this is good. And when I'm receiving cattle, he's come down there and helped me out a little bit. And he says, you know, he says, I'm starting to get worried about mom going out there by herself because, you know, these cows are plumb gentle and they don't mean to hurt you. But they get to start, you know, you go out there with that bag of cake and they do not have any boundaries. They shove you over. And then he's, you know, because I'm old and decrepit and I'm out there loading these cows on foot. And he'll show up a time or two and he's helped me load. And he's seeing the difference in his cows. And some of the cows that get in, they see somebody horseback once or twice a year. They get yeehawed, and they're hunting you. I actually get on the outside of the pen to work them out. Others are just kind of wild, crazy, bouncing off the walls. And those cows go out the alley, and they go down on the truck faster than his. I mean, they don't know what they're supposed to do. And, you know, they get into me, and I'll work them a little bit, and I'll get them to go over. But you get somebody, you know, they get down to the sale barn, and they got somebody in back of them with a horse. They're going to be slapping them with the reins and running into them with the horse and everything else to get them going. They're not doing those animals any favors.
Nope.
And then there's the whole other end of that equation that nobody looks at, is the difference in how they eat, what they eat, that whole thing, because we don't observe well. Two, and this was on that webinar this week, I'm bringing this up, is we really don't observe, then we don't remember what we observe. I had a teacher when I was in high school that he'd be thrown in jail today for this. But he had his desk sitting in the back of the room, and this one day he started acting like he was just in a grumpy, bad mood. And there was this one kid that was always in trouble anyways, and so he starts bantering back and forth to him. Kid gets up, goes out the door, and he slams the door. And the teacher just comes unglued. The next person that makes a noise is going to get it. Yeah, rah, rah, rah. Well, the kid comes back in, slams the door. This guy jumps up on the desk with a gun and boom, just shoots him. He drops to the floor. I mean, everybody just goes friggin' crazy running out the door. And I'm an idiot. You know, this guy up there, my instinct was to go for the teacher. So I'm fighting my way through everybody. And he's up there and he points that gun at me and goes, "You're next." And it's like, he's got the starting pistol. I said, "How are you going to shoot me with a starting pistol?" You know, in the middle of all this, my mind kind of, it just, my mind speeds up where everything's in slow motion. He brings everybody back into the room. He sets us down, 30, 35 kids in there, sets us down, has everybody write down what happened. Okay, and he collects the papers. And the class is over. The next day, we come in. He wants everybody to write down what happened the day before.
Okay. Think I see where
not
this is
only
going.
Was there 35 different descriptions on the first day, there's basically 35 different descriptions the second day. So even though we were right in the middle of that, we didn't see it. And then we come to the point that we don't know what we're doing when we're doing it. And I mean, it's something that we all do. And I had a guy that wanted me riding a horse for him, and he worked in a feed store, but he also trained on the side, and he actually had clients that were getting into the top 10 of the Arabian Nationals on the trail class, and he had this horse that was bucking them off, well, that's bucking the guy off that he had him started before 90 days and the horse was still bucking. So he has me riding. I'm riding it at his house, and he comes in for lunch, and he's watching me for a second. He goes, "How did you get that horse to two-tracking so fast?" I didn't even know what two-tracking was at that point. It was just something that I picked up doing on Bronx on my own, and I didn't, you know, I was just doing it. So he didn't believe me that I didn't know what it was, and I said, "Oh, you mean like this?" And I turned the horse where, you know, you've got the horse not really side passing. It's moving forward but drifting off to the side, and it's making two sets of tracks. And okay. I said, "Like that?" And he goes, "Yeah, how do you do that?" I didn't have a clue.
I don't know how I did it. I just did it.
I said, "I just do it." And he says, "Well, I want you to keep messing around with that." And he says, "Want to come out after I have my lunch? I want you to tell me how you do it." And to this day, I can't figure out what I'm doing with my hands. I mean, my fingers are just going, just giving and taking so much that it's almost like, you know, playing dueling banjos or something. But that gave me a clue that, yeah, sometimes I feel like I don't know what I'm doing. It's because I don't know what I'm doing. I'm just doing it. And all of us get into that. You know, we observe something that we think we see somebody else do, that we're going to do that, and then we go and we do it, and, oh, that doesn't work. And it's because, one, we didn't observe it in the first place, you know, to where we really understood it. And the second one was, we're not really doing what we think we're doing. I had a guy that was giving riding lessons to that he literally was laying back like a bareback rider. And I kept trying to get him to set up straight. I am sitting up straight. So I had a gal there with a video camera one day, and we're going to circle around this gal. And I'm telling him, "Sit up straight. I am. Sit up straight. I am. Then we took him down. We look, see that video, and goes, "I'm actually laying down, aren't I?" But we all do it.
Okay. I guess what you're saying there, and what I'm hearing and understanding, is our own perceptions of what we're doing are often flawed. Our own memories are often flawed. And sometimes it takes an external observer to show us, like, no, exactly, you need to sit up on the horse because your ass is laying down. Doesn't matter what you think. Here's the reality of what was actually going on.
Well, and
it's difficult for somebody, like, you know, I'm sure I've been in that position where, you know, you're yelling at me, "Sit up," and I'm thinking, "I am," and I'm, you know, leaned all the way back. That's just what I think that I'm doing, and my brain is just so wrapped up, I can't see what's actually going on.
Well, yeah, our ego will not allow us to realize that we don't know what we're doing.
Yes.
You know, and I've been accused of two things in my life. I've been accused of being an arrogant SOB, and I've also been accused of not having an ego.
How does that work?
Well,
was it the same person that was telling you
no,
that?
It's always different people.
Okay.
It's always different people. You know, if it's somebody that really gets, and I don't look at myself as a very intimidating person, but I've had people tell me that, "Oh, well, that person's intimidated by you," and it's like, why?
That's not
because I challenge what they think is the right way to do something. And they'll be in a situation this one place I went to work for, their sons have been trying to catch these bulls for months, and they were roping them and everything else to get them in. I just went out, and out of five of these bulls that they couldn't catch, I only roped one. And they were mad about it.
What'd you do with the others? Just walk them calmly into the corrals?
Well, yeah, and it's like, what got me hired on there is I was starting some colts for the guy, and he said they were going to brand and go out. And I had this gal, this friend of mine, that we went out, and they thought they'd put us on a wild goose chase. And they sent us down to this area where they had some cows that were kind of trotty that they'd been trying to get in. They couldn't get them in. And they said, well, if you can get those into the pen and then meet us up at this other place, this other set of pens. And about 2 hours later, we come pulling in there with my trailer and, oh, you give up already? Going, oh, no, they're in the pens. They stopped the branding and drove back down there 5 miles to make sure I actually had them in the pens. Their dad hired me. They were mad. You know, they'd been going in there with 3 or 4 good cowboys and they couldn't get them done. Well, what does a good cowboy do? As soon as they start running, by golly, you got to build to them. You got to get them cut off.
And oh, yeah.
Me, I just start kind of, okay, they're going down. Let's see. Probably come out in this ridge over here. So I just hop over a ridge and come out. And after doing this 3 or 4 times, they see you. They don't look at you as a threat. And they're still a little bit sensitive, but they go into the pen.
You let them run 3 steps. And then fade off, turn to the off pressure side, and 9 times out of 10, they'll take 2 or 3 more steps, stop, and look at you. But if you want to play cowboy and go run and chase, you can run to the other side of the pasture.
If you can do it quick enough, they'll just keep turning right around and go back. They don't even take 3 or 4 steps. They just, you can see them physically just depressure and just slow down and you know, where they start going fast to run, and then they just slow down to make that turn.
I know what you're talking about.
And people cannot grasp that. They can watch you do it time after time after time. And, well, the guy that I was working with down here, he told me that doesn't work. And the reason he kept saying it wouldn't work is because I'd have something that we're going to the gate and I'd fade off and it'd go out the gate and he'd be having a problem with it, so he's gonna help me. Well, instead of being on my outside hip, I'm fading off and that guy's passing me up to go to the head and he's just shoving it around, and he could never grasp back that the reason that fade that I made didn't work was because he was pushing the cow around me. Could not convince him of it. But he's actually the one that encouraged me to start teaching stockmanship.
I was sitting here, I kind of had like a little mental picture playing of what you were talking about. It's difficult to explain. And I ran into this with my dad several years ago when we were trying to, you know, I was in a side-by-side. He was on a four-wheeler, and we had a couple of people on horses, and we were trying to move a group of about 120 around a fairly small pasture. And he did this thing twice that made the whole, from all the way in the back, that made the whole front of the herd turn to the left. And he did it twice. And I went and I stopped him. We went off to the side. I said, what you're doing is almost right. But when you go just a little bit farther and you make that left-hand turn back into the herd, the front end is getting that pressure and they're turning left away from you. When you come out here and you're doing this maneuver, instead of turning left into the herd, drive one more second and then turn right and see what happens. So the next time, like, we had them and we were like moving them, like through that same trouble spot that we tried to get through 3 times already, instead of going up, instead of stripping down that backside and turning left into the herd to make his turn around, he went just a little past and turned right. Cows at the front just ignored him. Cows at the back just ignored him. They just kept going straight.
Exactly. But you can do that and they blame it on the cows. And
yep. Or they'll blame it on you.
Yeah. Yeah, that's usually what you get.
You're just standing there not doing a goddamn thing. Is that what it was?
Well, it was, I think, the second day of the school of record grimmers. And her and Justin were working these cattle. I mean, we're all sitting up on the on this little bluff and watching them. And they were stripping them. And as they stopped to turn, they were both riding colts. So what happened was they would turn, and they take a step or two in closer to the cows, and they start getting that hip turn going. Well, as they did that, the ones that were ahead of them saw that motion and started to go around with it. And they worked at that for about 5 minutes, and they had everything going the wrong direction. Everything's unpaired. Everything's balling. And they're thinking it's going to, okay, this is going to be the end of the day. And I just trotted down off, and I told them to get out of the way. And it took me three passes to turn everything around, have everything being quiet, and head in the right direction. I mean, it was one of those things that, you know, she said, I figured that was just going to be it for the day. I figured we'd be fighting them to get them turned around the rest of the day. But those passes, and all I did is come up and back of them, have my horse angled into them a little bit to where they saw me coming. And at that angle, it's the only thing I can think of is the way it works is because you're giving them an optical illusion that you're going to run into them. And so they start turning around, and a couple, three passes up like that, and all of them turned around and went in. So if you're riding a green horse, or if you're on a four-wheeler, obviously, instead of making that turn into the cow, you want to make turn away from. And people say, well, that gets your horse to not paying attention, but it's not. You're taking them off the cow, but then you're putting them right back on it.
It's also a pressure release.
Yeah.
You know, that's how they get things to move. You pressure them to get their attention, and then you release pressure to get them to move. Now, that pressure release, depending on how you know, where in flight zone you release that pressure, makes that animal want to go one direction or another.
Yeah.
Continued pressure is continued stress, and without the release, the stress level just continues to build, and things get faster and faster and faster until you have a wreck.
And if you use indirect pressure, you're just taking that stress level down even more.
What do you mean by indirect pressure when you're talking about livestock?
Okay, if you're wanting to go to a gate, and it goes right back to that saying that I cannot stand is you got to get their eye. You know, we're wanting to get the eye and get the pressure on that eye. Well, that's like hollering at a cow. They don't. Hollering them does not make them pay attention to you other than stress them out. You're trying to get that eye. In reality, unless you're in their blind spot, you have their eye.
If you can see their head, they can see you.
Yeah, exactly. Now, if you're going down and you're wanting a cow to go to the right and out the gate, and you start moving up to put pressure on that shoulder to push it over, and it starts speeding up to go around you because that's the cow's natural instinct. Well, if you're getting up close to where you want to look at that gate, and you turn your horse to where you are moving away from the gate. Now, you can have your horse bent into the cow and kind of two-track out like that. And that way your horse is paying right attention to that cow. If the cow does happen to turn back, you're already bent and it can turn around faster. But just having that horse move bent at that cow and moving away like that, that cow will start, okay, where can I go to get away from this pressure? And it looks at the gate, and it goes out the stinking gate.
I like how you say an optical illusion, but I don't think that's right. It's like, so when the cow's moving and you're out here, and then when you change to that two-track and you're moving like this, that tells the cow something different than when you're just paralleled.
Yeah,
right.
Well, you're
just paralleled on the hip. You know, as soon as you turn in, if you keep the same direction and motion, that's going to make the one that's going to make that animal want to turn away from you.
Yeah. And the thing is if you've got a horse that isn't, that you don't have any lateral movement on it, and you just turn that horse off to go off that way, they'll do it. But you've got to pay attention to the positioning on it and not go too far off, because then they'll straighten back out. So
they'll go with you.
Not necessarily. Yeah, they may try to straighten out or go out. But if you hold that position, then you got them going. You know, they'll keep going. If you start it like that and then you straighten back up, well, then they're going to speed up again. Put that pressure back on that head, they're going to speed up again.
Yeah.
And this is something, and this is stuff that Bud didn't teach because he couldn't figure out. I mean, heck, people didn't get the basics. You know, there'd be people going back 3, 4, 5 times to his schools and asking the same questions every time. So he assumed that was just too advanced to teach. And I thought about that for a long, long, long time. And it's everything that a cow does in reaction to us is basic.
Okay.
There is no advanced anything. It's all basic, instinctive reaction to what you're doing.
Okay.
And you cannot, and a lot of that is determined by how much feel you have with that animal, that sixth sense or whatever you want to call it. And you cannot teach that by watching a video or listening to lectures or just sitting there watching somebody. You've got to actually, I mean, you spend a little bit of time with me, you know, I'll show you something, and then I got to walk you through it before I ever turn you loose on it.
Right.
And that way you're actually getting that down a little bit, and hopefully you'll remember it enough to where when you go home to do it, that you, okay, that's not working. What am I doing wrong? And then you call me up and you get on the phone and video, what this dumb cow's doing? And then I can kind of walk you through it on the phone. But,
Well, your problem was you stepped off with the right foot instead of the left foot.
Yeah.
It comes down to that sometimes.
Yeah, it turned. Well, there's one of the videos I've got on this presentation was in Australia, and we were pinning some cows or putting them up an alley. And the one gal moves the back, and I'm kind of calling her off. And then I get this gal in the front, start to put a little bit of pressure on the front. And where I wanted to cut them off, and I have this red cow that's coming really fast. And all I did is pick that horse up to go like that. And I mean, that cow just stopped dead in her tracks.
You just made the horse's head
going boom, like that. It's so fast that you can't even hardly see it. And if somebody's just there watching it, they don't really have a clue to why that cow stopped.
Bob may have cut out on.